I love being a part of this place, and in part because we get to hear from such a diversity of voices and perspectives, and today's one of those days where things, where there's a kind of mysterious weaving happening, like a meditation that involves some contemplation of disappointment and setback, and a song about the deep end, which that's part of the deep end I'm interpreting. And the train I'd like to wander around in for the next few minutes. maybe I want to begin by saying that as I was talking last week, a little question lodged in my mind. And the question was something like, well, what's the difference between education or information collection and a word like initiation? What's the difference between education or learning about life and initiation? Initiation is a very old word. And of course, you know, I'm obsessed with all things ancient. And there's not a human culture on the planet that hasn't valued initiation. And developed, there's a difference, but developed rites of passage typically that were associated with an initiation. And to say the word initiation implies that one can be initiated or not. And that's troubling for modern people anyway, because we don't like hierarchies, especially liberal people. We're like, there are no hierarchies. So therefore what? Therefore what? There's no such thing as initiation. But I think in a very simple way, let me put it this way. Initiation, which means to begin, means that in part we need to begin again. It's one thing to be born. It's quite another to be born into a fuller expression of who you are in the world and what's yours to carry and how you might be a contributing member to society. And so initiation was a kind of beginning again. That's why so many of them, by the way, involved a kind of ritual death and a ritual rebirth. Because they were saying, time to begin your real life. Childhood was great, but now if you get to go to the deep end, it's going to be a little bit more dangerous. And I know you weren't saying this in your song, Matt, but might involve a kind of ritual drowning between the shallow end and the deep end. And that's challenging. It's challenging. How many of you would agree that life is challenging? Okay. So how do we bring more consciousness to that? And an ancient word like initiation helps at least raise the question. So that's the train I want to try to talk about today. Here's another dimension. And we get this from a combination of evolutionary biology, or what we might, if there's such a thing as cultural evolution, and sociology, that adolescence is a pretty new phenomenon when it comes to the human species. It's a pretty new phenomenon. Meaning this, I don't know if you know of this or not, but young people all go through puberty. Are you familiar with this? Okay. I don't know if you remember that, but you went through it too. And in a very simple sense, from a biological point of view, this prepares you to be a reproductive member of society. Not a productive member, necessarily, but a reproductive member of society. And in the ancient world, of course, life expectancy was much shorter. If you made it to 40, you were old, really, and you had done it. Not there, there were, of course, exceptions to this, but life was much more challenging. You could, you know, you could fall on the way to work and cut your hand, and that could be a mortal injury that could kill you. So life was much more challenging. And most ancient cultures, whether they were hunter-gatherers or agrarian, which is most of our known human history, you had to be a productive, not just a reproductive, member of society very quickly. You know, sometimes you hear about, well, you know, young men and young women got married so early, and that was part of patriarchal abuse, and they should have waited. They didn't have a choice, okay? It was as when you are as the absolute peak of your physical fitness, have babies now. And that will help support the tribe and the culture and the society. What's my point? Somewhere along the lines, this time period from childhood to adulthood started to appear on the scene, which we call adolescence. And you're sort of in a liminal space here. You're not an adult, everyone agrees, and you're not a kid. It's after puberty. So you're in this middle ground. And really, if I just bring some of my own sort of interpretations to the details here, to the facts of history, the Industrial Revolution, and maybe you could even pull that back a bit, created the possibility to hang out in that time period longer, meaning that liminal space between being a kid and being an adult. And we now have words for that, like college. And that's a very interesting cultural phenomenon, and it seems to be almost global at this point. And what we also know is that if you ask the question, when does adolescence end? We all feel like, well, it depends, you know. Jesus lived at home till he was 30, you know. So that's, for one thing, talk about extending adolescence. So anyway, pretty new phenomenon. And to a certain extent, we're not sure what to do with it, but it involves the question of, in my view, initiation. How do you move from being a kid to being an adult? What's that like? And I'm suggesting an element has always been a descent. Always, there's always been some kind of descent, whether it was ritualized, put in the context of whatever rituals the community is helping their young people pass through. Whether there's a ritual or not, it involves some kind of descent. Because what's the worst thing for society, you could say, is an adolescent that continues on the upwardly mobile path of God or goddess-like status where they're the center of the universe. Is that good for the community at large? No. That's why the Greeks had so many myths about hubris. That's the myth of Icarus. His father makes the wings, but the joints are made of wax, and he warns him, if you fly too close to the sun, the joints in your wings are going to melt and you're going to crash, and he does. That's a story of adolescence, by the way. That's a story of asking the question of initiation. How do you use the wings? That's really the question. How do you use wings? And what happens if you don't learn to use them well? Either you end up dead in the sea or you wreck society. Both of those are possible. So I'm making a case for right now in the 21st century, in, I almost said the year 2020. What year is it? 2021. Why should we be having this conversation? Well, I'll tell you one thing that you can disagree with if you want. Well, adolescence is getting extended. And I might even say that we are coming to worship at the altar of adolescence. This is why you'll see, I'm sure you've never done this, mothers competing with their daughters to shop at the same places for the same kind of clothes. Or fathers, for that matter. You know, I still dress like I'm in high school, you know? I mean, this is me dressed up. This is like me at my top. I'm top of my game right now, okay? Full adult mode right now. But we've come to worship adolescence, youth. And we have a whole industrial medical complex committed to this. So here's a claim I'm going to make. A culture without elders is in trouble. That's claim number one. A culture without elders is in trouble. And I want to just keep saying that, because what do I want all of us to become? Elders. Because a culture without elders is in serious trouble. but we could say a culture without adults is dangerous. You don't go from teenager to elder. A culture without adults, a culture that's obsessed still with adolescence in adulthood. I'm not blaming the kids here at this point. The kids are fine. What's that movie, The Kids Are All Right? That's a great movie, by the way. A culture without adults is dangerous. So why should we be talking about this right now? Because we're born for these times. We're born to address this phenomenon of extended adolescence. So I want to do this in two ways. I want to give you a drive-through of just some ideas that I've been wrestling with through the work of Bill Plotkin, one of my mentors and teachers that you've heard me talk about before, about some stages here. This is somewhat abstract. Then if we have time, I'll tell you a couple myths, or also drive-through versions of the myths. They're quite long. Because I want to look at, if we have time, a masculine expression of this initiation and descent, and a feminine expression of this initiation and descent. And then, hopefully I'll run out of time and not end with my, have to read my poem again. But we'll see. Okay. All right, how to begin. So, I'm going to give you three images. This all comes from the work of Bill Plotkin in a book called Nature and the Human Soul. It's a model, really. It's a model that's simply trying to say, what's it like to grow up? And here are eight stages for us to wrestle with. Models are different than like theories, really. They're more like maps, and we say, okay, how do they line up with what the actual terrain is like? So it's a little like that, but I'm going to hone in on just three stages here, only briefly, and I'm going to give you images that will help you. So one of the things that Plotkin says is that stage three, he associates with early adolescence, all right, stage three. You know, the numbers don't matter so much here, but just go with me. And the image that's most strongly associated with that age, he says, is the thespian, the actor. And I like thespian because it's just like a slightly richer expression of that same thing. And wouldn't you agree, if you've ever met someone in early adolescence, that there's a bit of thespian activity going on? That's not good or bad, okay? That's the way it should be. Because you're trying out, what is it like to be me? What's it like to move around in this world? Who am I? What's my identity? What group do I belong with? In fact, the main concerns of stage three, the thespian, is peer group, sex, and society. Okay? What group am I in? Who can I sleep with? And where do I fit in the larger thing called society? That's where all the energy is going. And you could say, that's just the way it is. It's a great gift. Maybe you could even say one of the gifts of this stage of development is fire. Teenagers are fiery, are they not? So this kind of fervent passion, and by the way, I should add one thing. There's a bit of a paradox at work in this stage of life, the thespian, which is I need to be who I am and I need to fit into the right group. Do you feel the tension between those things? And so you're always looking for, I want to be my authentic self and I want to fit in. And that's just going to cause all kinds of problems. But they're fun problems for the early adolescent. They're fiery problems. And hopefully, over time, in a healthy enough society, and if the kid is healthy enough, they'll come to a greater sense of authenticity as they're passing through this stage. There's also the possibility that they'll go the way of capitulation and conformity, where a bit of my authentic self I begin to let go of, and I become much more concerned with what group do I fit into. So things don't always go well. In fact, Bill Plotkin says, the problem is not that we have stage three, adolescence, but that the broader culture is, here's the phrase, is pathologically adolescent. We've just extended what is a great gift and called that the point of adulthood. Think about it. What's the point of being adult? Peer group, sex, and society. What do our advertisements sell us? Peer group, sex, and society. Before the pandemic, I had a Volkswagen bus. Talk about pathologically adolescent, okay? And I sold it, trying to be an adult. And I bought a 2010 Mercedes Sprinter van with now 210,000 miles on it, which is the cooler version of a Volkswagen bus, basically. And I got into this, like, it's like a work van slash, you know, you can put a bed in there and drive around. It's not like one of the, it's not a full camper or something like that. But anyway, I'm now in this club, and I can tell from my Instagram, all the advertisements are getting me to look at things associated with this whole van culture. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about? Okay, what are they selling me? Not products. They're selling me social status, peer group, sex, and society. Every single one of them. You will fit in if you stay in this particular group. All right? Now, I'm just picking on myself so that you'll also take a look at your own life and say, are these concerns of that you have? Or take a look at mainstream culture and say, what is it that they're trying to keep us locked into? And we might say, into a pathologically adolescent place. Now, I'll finish the stages. Stage four, Bill Plotkin calls the wanderer. And I almost don't even need to say more about what that is. You wander. You genuinely leave home. And the center of gravity stops becoming peer group, sex, and society. And you start to go deeper into the questions of who am I at my core? What's really true? You can see through, you begin to see through the lies. You might start to think of them at the time. Lies of culture. Oh, if I just play this game, I'll be eternally happy and well-liked and everything will make sense. A deeper part of you says, no, that's not the case, and I have to wander to find out. If you look at the story of the Buddha, there is no story of the Buddha if he stays inside the walled garden that is home, that is paradise, where everything is supplied for him. He has to leave and wander around, which he does. By the way, the thing that kicks him out of the walled garden is confrontation with an old man. Did you know that? He had never seen age before. And now we're starting to talk about swimming toward the deep end. There has to be some kind of descent. It has to smack you in the face, in the case of the Buddha, and say, we're going to die? How come no one ever told me about death? If that doesn't come as a serious existential crisis in a time period of wandering, you'll just get stuck in the pathologically adolescent culture where I'm going to live forever. Perpetual youth. Have I made sense so far? Stage five, which I'm not going to spend much time on, I'm just going to mention it, is you come out of the wandering phase. You go into a descent, some kind of descent, whether chosen or not, usually not chosen, but confrontation with the larger realities of life, it shakes you up in such a way. And stage five, the image, is something like an artisan. You come back and say, well, I'd like to do something other than just please myself the rest of my life. And that's an adult. That's the beginning of an adult. I'd like to live my life in such a way where I'm not the center of the universe anymore. I want to make a contribution to the concerns and cares of the larger community, the larger Earth community. That's the beginning of adulthood. And I want to say, if we live in a pathologically adolescent culture, there aren't that many adults. Really. You might disagree. I doubt if you do. Okay. As promised, that was a drive-through version. Now, the question becomes, what kinds of things help us go on this little wander, go on the descent? Why does it involve a descent? Why must we be confronted with some, at least some disappointment or suffering or challenge to face up to the larger reality? I don't know the answer to that question. It just seems to be the great pattern of the way things are. And in the ancient world, they had all kinds of rites of passage, slightly different than initiation, but a rite of passage, events that would help push you in this direction. I'll give you some of them, like the walkabout. Or there are different versions of the walkabout. There's some in Africa and some in Australia. But there's one in Africa where the boys have to wander around until they can learn how to cry. Then they can come back. That's very interesting, isn't it? Why? It's not like wander around till you can, you know, prove that you're tough. It's the opposite. If you can cry, you can be a full member of society and come back and be an adult. These kinds of things are led by elders who know that dissent is necessary to be a contributing member to the larger whole. Other kinds of things. Well, Jesus went through his own, sort of self-initiated, 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, fasting, in other words. You have that also in the Native American tradition, in the Lakota tribe and others, where, you know, fasting is not like a good time. It's not like, man, I'm just like getting my body weight down and, you know, developing lean muscles. And it's not a fitness thing. It's deprivation and hardship, chosen intentionally to wake you up. Say, what am I about? What is my culture about? What is life about? So I don't perpetually stay in peer group sex and society, but I'm broken in some way into something larger. I don't know, other rituals that I can think of are digging your own grave, always a good time, that you will actually lie down in. Talk about that. Imagine. Let's say your kid is about to turn 16. You're like, I've got you a car. But before you get the car, before I give you the keys, we're going to go out and we're going to dig your grave. You're going to dig it. And that's where we're going to bury you if you crash this thing. Now, you think that's strange. I don't. I think that sounds like a good idea, really. By the way, I'm not making that up. That really is an ancient ritual, digging your own grave. Rolling in ashes. You know, Ash Wednesday is the really polite version of what used to be rolling in ashes. I am dust. I am ashes. I will be burned. So I don't, you know, it's better to get burned early than, like Icarus, fly too close to the sun and crash. Make sense? So the ancient ways we've turned our nose up at, and that's a question I'm carrying. I'm not going to go into much more detail now, but do we need any of these things? Or what are contemporary expressions? I'm not the kind of person that says if we just did it exactly like they did it back then, we'd all be fine. That's not the way things work. I understand. Cultures evolve. We evolve. We're always evolving. We're always changing. But we still have to ask, what from the ancient world still concede our present questions? And is there anything that's worth reimagining now in the 21st century? Because I look around and think, yep, our culture is having a hard time growing up. And two myths, and I'll go as fast as I can. The first is Psyche and Eros. Psyche and Eros, this is such a fantastic myth, by the way. So Psyche is very beautiful. She's human, very beautiful, and she's so beautiful that men start to fall in love with her and stop worshiping the goddess Aphrodite, who is more of transpersonal feminine beauty. And they start focusing on the human. But it's a bit misplaced, and she's confused by it. And that's a very interesting element in the story, too. What's the difference between worshiping the feminine and really seeing a human being? And so she's experiencing some suffering because of this. And so her father goes to the oracle, and the oracle says, well, she's got to die because this is, nobody's happy here. Aphrodite is all upset, and everything's just gone to pot, so she needs to die. And so they take her out to a hillside, Psyche. And instead, Eros, which is Aphrodite's son, who's sent to kill her because Eros carries weapons, the arrows, accidentally pricks his own finger and falls in love with her. Okay? And then sweeps her away. And for a time period, they live in this kind of unconscious romantic fantasy where everything is awesome. It's otherwise known as when we fall in love. Everything is awesome. The other person is awesome. But Eros has one rule. You can't see me. I'll come to you at night, but in the morning I'm gone, and you can't see me, which is the same thing as falling in love. Because if you look too carefully, you're not going to like what you see, all right? So we like to live in the fantasy, but it's unconscious, and she's in that kind of realm. Eventually, her sisters turn her against Eros. She doesn't know it's Eros, doesn't know it's a god, and says, the person you're sleeping with is a monster. There's truth there. And take a lantern, light the lantern, go to him at night with your knife and kill the monster, and it will end all this madness. So she does. She lights the lamp, carries the knife, and sees that it's a god, and falls in love again. And falls in love more consciously at this point. Eros wakes up because she gets kind of shaky and drips some wax on him, and he flies away. All right. And then everything, this is where the myth is very long, gets very in-depth. What happens is that she becomes near suicidal at this point. She does try to kill herself. And she so longs for Eros, and Eros feels so betrayed in a sense, and also longs for her in a weird way. She's sent through a series of tasks. Finally, Aphrodite says, all right, I'll not kill you if you can do these tasks. And there are four of them. Four of them is a very special number in myths anyway. The first three involve a bunch of stuff I won't have time to explain. The fourth one involves a visit to the underworld. Okay, and I'm mentioning that because this is what descent is like. I'm telling you, initiation in the deepest sense involves some terrain in the underworld. You have to go down into darkness. There's not another way. She cannot become a fully conscious human being or really know what it means to love without fantasy or not completely consumed by fantasy, so she has to visit the underworld. So she goes to Persephone, down in the underworld, queen of the underworld, and she's told by Aphrodite, I need this like special perfume, essentially. Take it and come bring it to me. So she goes in the underworld, all kinds of tasks she has to do. It's very much like the hero's journey from a feminine point of view. Definitely worth reading. She comes out of the underworld, and you know how it is. Go get the perfume, but you're not allowed to use it. So it's like here's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now don't eat from it. It's just that's what's going to happen, and Persephone can't help it, and she cracks it open. It's kind of like Pandora's box, and this black vaporous cloud comes over and puts her to sleep. This is Sleeping Beauty. This is before Sleeping Beauty, there was the Psyche story. So she falls asleep. And at that point, Eros comes in and they re-fall in love. I won't tell you this part of the story, but I want to pause here because there's a very interesting element. For Persephone to grow up out of unconsciousness, she has to do what's forbidden and take something that she wants with consciousness. She has to steal from the gods, basically. She has to break the gods' hearts, and she has to go against her own culture. This is part of becoming an individual. If there's not a stealing element somewhere built in there, there's not what Jung would call individuation, but if you want to use a less fancy word, becoming an individual. You can't become an individual if you remain unconscious, if you remain doing whatever the society is telling you to do at all times, trying to remain safe. There has to be some element that says, I'm a human being, I'm going to take this, and there are going to be consequences, and it's going to hurt. In this case, she falls asleep. Okay. Story number two. I told you I was going to go quickly, and I'm sorry, Matt, you can just keep playing. You will edit nothing. Okay. Second story, Iron John. I've been thinking a lot about Iron John because Robert Bly died a couple weeks ago. So here's the story of Iron John, just 4.3% of the story. Okay. I'm going to start in a moment of the story where there's a wild man who's been locked up in a cage in the center of town and mostly forgotten about. Because that's what happens when society begins to discover the instinctual, the wild, the hairy, the swampy. We lock it up. He said, that's not good. We'll lock it up. That way it won't wreak havoc. Well, one day the king's son is playing with his golden ball, and yes, that's a kind of euphemism, and the ball falls on the ground and rolls into the wild man's cage. So this sets up a dilemma. For the boy to become a man, to become a king eventually, he needs the golden ball, and he has to let the wild man out of the cage. Because the wild man says, I'll give you your ball back, but you got to unlock the door. And they negotiate this, and finally, the boy says, I can't. My mom has the key. It's under her pillow. And the wild man says, then you got to steal it. Here's where the element of Psyche and Iron John are speaking the same kind of language. For the boy to grow up, he has to break his parents' heart and steal the cage and suffer the consequences, which he does. He lets the wild man out of the cage, and he hurts his finger. There's always a wound. There's always a wound. What's my main point in initiation? Part of growing up mythologically from the great stories is that there has to be a descent, and it has to hurt. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. I'm sorry. Little boy's just going to say, you know what, have the ball. I'm going to go back and sit at mom's table, and she's just going to praise me, and it's just going to be wonderful, all right? So I'll fast forward. The boy goes to the woods with Iron John is his name. The wild man teaches him the secrets of the forest, and he starts breaking the wild man's rules because one of the tasks is to keep things from falling into this sacred spring, and the little boy can't help it. He sticks his finger in there, the hurt one, and it turns to gold. And eventually his hair, he leans over, stares in like Narcissus, but in this case his hair falls in to the water where he's looking at his own reflection. His head turns gold, and the wild man says, okay, you've broken my rules. You have to go back to society, wrap your head up so people won't see your golden locks, and you can never live here again. If you need my help, I'll come and help you. Come and shout at the edge of the forest, I'll help you. But you have to go back into society and back into culture. And what happens at the point of this story is he has to start at the bottom with what's called kitchen work. He has to work in the kitchen. He has to work with ashes. He cannot become the king. He cannot take his head thing off and show his golden locks until he works with in the kitchen. And what Robert Bly says is, this is catabasis. This is going down. Young people do not grow up unless they go down. So they need two things. They do need to be told or experience their own golden qualities, or in Psyche's respect, her own inner beauty. It's there. And they have to experience a going down. Kitchen work or down into the underworld. There is not another way to grow up than to go down. That's what the stories say. And that's what makes them so, I think, unpalatable to a modern adolescent consciousness, which praises only upward mobility, only perpetual youth. What business do we have rolling in ashes, biting cinders? We don't like that stuff. And therefore, our young people don't grow up, and we don't have real adults. Okay. Best to end with a poem. Here we go. One day, the earth opens her mouth and swallows you whole, and God turns God's back. Or you look back and are turned to salt, and God twiddles God's thumbs and disappears into the cloud you know nothing about. It takes a long time, this terrible weaning, the wolf mother who leaves you sucking air instead of milk. No one comes looking for you, unlike Elijah, whose friends travel from mountain to mountain in search of their friend. You are so far gone, even the voice of your lover sounds like a voicemail you never managed to delete. I, for one, wish this on no one except some of you. The ones I'd like to kiss, like Judas, and betray you. So you can feel again how you've betrayed yourself. Just remember, if this happens to you, do not fall in love with your stories. Do not cling to any images. Do not pray unless you must. Do not blame, and do not run. Thanks.